In a letter to the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, LULAC said, quote, "These actions echo a troubling history of voter suppression and intimidation that has long targeted both Black and Latino communities, particularly in states like Texas," end quote. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 89 degrees and partly cloudy. In New York City, 82 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon. I'm Parisa Neruzzi, and this is Taking Action on WPFW 89.3 FM. We come to you every Tuesday at 1 o'clock, bringing information and inspiration that you need so that you can take action in our city to fight displacement, save our schools and communities, stand up for justice, build our power, and hold government officials accountable. Taking Action is produced by the grassroots organization Empower DC. We welcome your feedback and your show ideas. You can call Empower DC at 202-234-9119 or go to our website, empowerdc.org. Want to just say hi to the listeners. Thank you for making our latest fund drive a success and keeping WPFW moving. Such an important institution here in our city that we cherish and want to continue to support as long as possible. Also want to say hey to all the kids going back to school and just wishing everybody a great year. My daughter just entered the fourth grade. I remember the fourth grade, so hopefully this will be a good year for her. I hope everybody in DC public schools in particular is going to have a great year. Excited for today's show. We're going to have two segments. The second is a very brief segment, but our first, I'm going to get to speak with somebody who I respect and admire very much, Dr. Shacobi Wilson, who is a leading environmental justice champion here in our nation, not even just regionally. And then before we close today, I am going to welcome guests from the Emerald Cities Collaborative to share some information about a program that they are offering for DC area small business contractors, electricians, plumbers, folks like that, who want to green their businesses and become able to perform for DC's higher standards now of energy resilience and energy performance standards. So let me introduce my first guest. Dr. Shacobi Wilson is a professor with the University of Maryland College Park in the School of Public Health, where he directs the SEAGE Center, the Center for Community Engagement, Environmental Justice, and Health. He has decades of experience working with environmental health science, exposure, environmental justice, health disparities, community-based participatory research, water quality, air pollution, and so many EJ-related issues. He works in partnership with community-based organizations to study and address environmental justice and health issues and translate research into action. And on a personal note, Dr. Shacobi Wilson has been a great friend and colleague to Empower DC. He supported our efforts over a decade ago to defeat a proposed bus terminal that would have been created at the historic Alexander Crummell School in Ivy City. And today he's a colleague in a program called the TICTAC, the Thriving Communities Technical Assistance Centers program, of which he's one of the leads, and Empower DC is a partner. Dr. Wilson is a leading voice of accountability within the EJ movement. He speaks truth to power, he convenes partners, and he ensures that the progress that we're making as a movement is truly led by and inclusive of smaller grassroots partners. And so we welcome you, Dr. Jacoby Wilson, to Taking Action. Thanks for joining us again. How are you?
Happy to be here. Thanks for that great introduction. Thanks for having me today. How are you doing today, Parisa?
I'm doing okay. You know, just trying to keep everything moving. And I know you have a lot on your plate. You have an upcoming event that we'll talk about in depth here in a moment, the 10th Environmental Justice Symposium, with 4 days of information and networking and technical support, all about building the EJ movement. So we want our listeners to know about that. But for those who don't know you, Dr. Jacoby, will you please just step back a moment, tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, how you got into this movement and the work that you do with the Siege Center?
Yeah, thank you. So, yeah, again, really excited to be here. You know, I'm from Mississippi, just to get a little bit of background. So I'm a Southern, you know, Southern boy from Mississippi, grew up in Vicksburg, Mississippi. You know, as I kind of recount, you know, my childhood in Vicksburg, you know, for those of you who know literature, I was like a little Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn kind of guy, if you enter that kind of literature. I don't live that far from the Mississippi River. So grew up, you know, loving nature, enjoying nature. But also, you know, as I talk about my work as a EJ environmental justice researcher and advocate, you know, I grew up near a little concrete crushing facility. I grew up, you know, near a sewage treatment plant. I grew up near a major highway. And my mom always say, son, don't forget you grew up near a landfill too. So we had a lot of these environmental hazards nearby. Not like it was right. No, we weren't fence line. Our neighborhood wasn't fence line to the hazards. Probably went in like, you know, half a mile, right? So like the bus route in the morning time, we would go pick up kids who live right by the landfill. But we would always have to travel, you know, across that highway. And then my pops was a pipe fitter. And so he worked at Grand Gulf Nuclear Power Station, which is in the sort of the background, not that far from Alcorn State. For those who know Alcorn State, one of our historically Black colleges, famously where Steve McNair, y'all may be seeing a documentary about his life that's also, he went to Alcorn State. And so, you know, my dad was a pipe fitter, so he was working in these hazardous environments. And also growing up, you know, Mississippi, you know, which is interesting, quick tidbit, you know, I'm almost 50. So, you know, growing up in Mississippi, you know, you think about integration, right? They were still integrating schools when I was a kid in many ways. Because, you know, Southern states were slow on integration. So I was getting some of that racism, right? That discrimination as a young person. Not knowing why. And then another thing for me growing up, you know, I have alopecia, which is baldness and patches. For many of you who may have lupus out there, you know, that's an autoimmune condition, right? That a lot of women of color have, Black women have. Alopecia is a similar autoimmune condition where, you know, immune system attacks the hair follicles. So I've been, you know, dealing with alopecia since a little kid. So all those experiences with the racism, with the alopecia, you know, living near these environmental hazards really got me interested in environmental health and really understanding how the environment impacts health, right? And so from there, I had the opportunity to go to a historically Black college, Alabama Agricultural Mechanical University in Huntsville. I had some great mentors. I say to this day, for all you young people out there, mentors are important. Still to this day, my best mentors, fortunately or unfortunately, were my undergraduate mentors, right? Now, when it comes to the work that I do today, my best mentors are community leaders, what we get into, the folks who are actually in the field being impacted by the issues, who are the real contextual experts, right? But that undergrad experience was important for me. And I remember going to a conference at Elizabeth City State, another HBCU in North Carolina, where I met Reverend Dr. Benjamin Chavis, who those of you know who coined the term environmental racism in the fight against the polychlorine and Bifino landfill in Warren County, North Carolina. And I also met Dr. Robert Bullard, who's known by many as the father of the environmental justice movement. So just to speed this up, when I went to that conference, I knew I was gonna be doing environmental justice the rest of my life. So I'll pass the mic back to you, Parisa.
Yeah, that's a beautiful story. Thank you for sharing that and your, you know, early background that has obviously shaped and informed your interests and your life's work, which is a you know, positive outcome despite those challenges. So I want to, you know, not take for granted that our listeners exactly know what we're talking about when we say environmental justice. So I wonder if you could share a little bit more framing of just, you know, what, when we talk about environmental justice, what are we talking about, and how does the work of the Siege Center directly, you know, relate and address environmental justice?
Yeah, thank you. So for those of you in the audience, we're talking about environmental justice. We're talking about where we live, work, play, pray, and learn, how some communities, due to their, you know, race, ethnicity, of the, you know, demographics of folks living in the community, maybe due to their income, they tend to be overburdened, have a disproportionate burden of environmental hazards and what we call locally unwanted land uses. That's sort of traditional framing. So that could be having a higher concentration of highways and traffic-related air pollution in your community. So we got an acronym called TRAP, not trap music, but different kind of trap, right? Or you could have more incinerators in your community. You could have more factories community. You could have more landfills in your community. And because of your race, class, you know, income, you know, some groups tend to have more on average of these type of uses, which tend to be pollution intensive. What I mean by that is define it. They emit more toxicants to the air, water, and soil that can impact air quality, water quality, right? Can impact soil quality, but also can impact human health. So you think about why we have such high asthma rates in communities of color is due to the environmental stressors that you may be exposed to, whether it be indoor air pollution, you may have more mold, mildew, allergens, or off-gassing from paints, adhesives, right, furniture, or you could have cook stove issues where you have more exposure to particulate matter, which is dust in the air, or volatile organic compounds. Many of you are familiar with that new car smell. Hold your breath. Those are VOCs. So think about benzene toluene, formaldehyde, right? Y'all know formaldehyde from science class. Those of you a little bit older, remember formaldehyde from your science classes, the frogs, right? But then you think about outdoor air pollution. So particulate matter, again, dust in the air. So you think about high asthma rates or stroke or heart disease, right? In some communities, it's because of their environmental exposure. So where you live, your zip code is more important than your genetic code. Place matters, context matters. Where you live can literally kill you. And for those of you who live in DC, for those of you in Baltimore, for those of you who live in other parts of the country, we live in an urban area, right? You can see major differences in life expectancy, right? In wards 7 to 8 compared to other wards in DC. Major difference in life expectancy in parts of Baltimore, right? Because some communities have more access to infrastructure, more green space, more trees, more grocery stores, less pollution, and others have more of those bad things and less of the good things. So we think about environmental injustice, communities have more of the harms, right? The environmental harms, the social harms, and less of the benefits. People are experiencing toxic trauma. Think about when you have highways and byways going through your community every day and people are dumping combustion byproducts. What does it do to your health? Not just the respiratory impacts, but also the impacts on your DNA, the impacts on reproduction, right? So pollution kills, toxicants kill. And some of our communities are being used as dumping grounds for these hazards, these locally wanted land uses. So that's what environmental injustice is, but the environmental movement is a movement against that. It's a movement for empowerment. It's a movement about liberation. How do we liberate communities from environmental oppression? How do we liberate communities from environmental exposures? How do we liberate communities from these toxicants? And at the same time, y'all, let me bring in climate justice. The same communities who have been overburdened by environmental hazards and these lulus, right? These pollution emitters, they tend to be ones that have differential risk from climate change. Now, listeners, you may not believe in climate change, but believe in you're Black. If you're Latino, if you're poor, if you don't have healthcare, you've been in a floodplain, you got underlying health issues, if you're a child, if you're older, particularly if you're older, think about it, y'all. Heat waves are hell for the poor and the elderly. Right now, we have folks who've been dying from heat exposures, right? So heat is a physical stressor, where air pollution is a chemical stressor. So we have folks who've been impacted by both environmental and climate injustice. And my center, we talk about empowerment science. And I'm going to say this, spell this out for y'all. I empowerment, as Parisa said in her introduction, how do we build power? How do we grow power? How do we use science so people are collecting their own data? Like we have community scientists. Y'all don't have to have a PhD, have no degree to be a scientist. The fact that you live in these communities, You're collecting data every day, right? So you are a scientist. You're trying to do something about it. So we want to empower you through science and tools to be able to impact change and liberation science. How do we liberate folks again from environmental exposures, environmental oppression? That's what our work is about.
Thank you so much. And I know our listeners are perked up listening because you're a powerful speaker, Dr. Wilson. And, you know, I don't know if you were a preacher in a former life or anything like that, but you've got a ministry here for sure.
Oh, yes. I always joke, Parisa, I'm a research minister. If those of you don't know me, when I get excited, either I start talking real fast, I'm from Mississippi and I talk real fast. That's a joke. But also I go into preacher mode. So yes, I do that a lot.
No, I love it though. It's great. We need that, that energy. And you know, to what you were saying, just to put it in context here in DC, we talk a lot on our show about Ivy City. This is a community that we've been rooted in for a couple decades now. And that's a great example of how environmental injustice has played out, this over concentration of industrial land. More than half of the industrial land in DC is right around Ivy City, Brentwood, in this Ward 5 area along New York Avenue. And, you know, some people say, oh, well, it's, you know, the industrial stuff was there first. Actually, no. This was a Black residential community that was built in 1873, 150 years ago, about 50 years before zoning existed. And when zoning was created in the 20s and then in the, you know, the ensuing years, that's when the industrial sites started being, you know, concentrated around, again, this Black residential community that had grown up, you know, just moments after emancipation. So just think about that full story. And it's such a clear example. And then you mentioned, you know, some of the consequences of that, the extreme heat, the, you know, the health effects of air pollution. And so our communities here in DC, of course, experiencing this.
Think about that, what Parisa just said, y'all. Freedmen's. We're talking about freedmen's community. I used to term liberation. You have folks who just liberated, right? We got a national holiday now, Juneteenth. Liberated. And then still exploited. Still enslaved, because then we're going to weaponize zoning against you because of your skin color. Dr. Bullitt says some communities have the complexion for protection, and some folks don't. There's a book called Color of Law. Think about how your skin color, right? If you don't have a certain complexion, pigmentation, you may not have the law equally applied in your community, or you may get dumped or zoning. You may have in more industrial zones in your community where another community due to a different skin tone or a different income class doesn't. Zoning's been weaponized against our communities, right? And so inequities in planning, zoning, and development is a major driver of environmental injustice. So equity in planning, zoning, and development is a solution to environmental justice, to advance environmental justice. I just want to add to your point.
No, absolutely. I appreciate that. And that's one of the reasons why Empower DC has gotten more and more involved in land use planning around, you know, planning. Yep. Zoning, you know, trying to intervene, you know, the comprehensive plan, all of these things. And of course, those were all systems and arenas that were not set up to create equitable outcomes. So we have a lot of work to do to even infiltrate those rooms that were, you know, set up to exclude people, but then also to change the policies. You know, we're in an interesting moment in the EJ movement. I mean, the movement has been growing for decades and has done incredible work. And now we find ourselves in this moment where you have a president who says that he has a commitment to environmental justice and is pouring money into federal grants and programs that are stated to address environmental justice. I wonder if you could speak from your perspective about this moment that we're in. You know, I guess, like, what is the risk and the reward? You know, what are we facing right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, y'all. So, you know, we just had a historical reflection, right, about, you know, Freedmen's communities, right? You can talk about Jim Crow era and how just a lot of the continuation of oppression of folks of color post-slavery occurred, right? And the environmental justice movement in many ways, it's a child of the civil rights movement, right? And you see this erosion of civil rights that are happening. You see some of the Supreme Court cases out there that's happening. But this movement is a movement that's trying to preserve those rights, right? And in many ways, environmental movement is a human rights movement, right? You have a human right to clean air, clean water, safe food, safe housing, good job. One of the EJ icons I like to, reference, his name was Dr. Bunyan Braun. He recently passed. He was a professor emeritus at the University of Michigan. He talked about environmental justice is realizing your fullest potential expansion the isms, right? Yeah, that's an octopus of oppressions to add to that. So we're talking about racism, the sexism, that's all, it's a whole different arms of that octopus. We're fighting against that octopus of oppression. So that means we're looking at these issues intersectionality, right? And so he also talked about environmental justice can be achieved when you can have good paying jobs, safe schools, safe housing. Biological diversity and cultural diversity are revered, right? So for those of you in public health, you may have heard the term social determinants of health. You know, school policies impact health, economic policies impact health, right? And so I just want to reflect on that real quickly and get back to your question about like what he's talking about, like, you know, everything impacts health, but if bad policies can lead to poor health outcomes. And so you think about how racism and oppression and discrimination are embedded in those policies, right? So you have a president, right? You have this history, this EJ movement. You go the PCB landfill fight that I mentioned, and, you know, others, Dolly Burwell, Reverend Dr. Chavis. You have, you know, fights, Cesar Chavez, you know, those agricultural fights, right? You got the history of work in Gulf Coast and Cancer Alley. You got work We Act for Environmental Justice. You got the history of folks of fighting for indigenous rights in the indigenous lands across this country, right? Folks in energy country, coal country fighting. There's so many examples of folks fighting for environmental justice over, as you said, over the decades, right? And now you come to the last few years with this administration. And I'm gonna be honest, y'all, I've loved a lot of what this administration has done. I've been a cheerleader, right? I wrote a blog on Medium called "Will President Biden Be the First Climate Justice President?" Just for transparency, right? Just for also as a thought piece. Because if you look at the work over the years, and y'all can, and the audience can push back on this, particularly you EJ advocates out there, I think this president has done more for environmental justice than any other president in the history of presidents, okay? You got executive orders out there on environmental justice, 14008, this is Justice 40. So for those who don't know, to Bruce's question, you know, that Justice 40 executive order is really about moving our country forward to a clean energy economy, making sure those are most disadvantaged benefit from that transition, that just transition. So a term we use is called distributional justice. How do we make sure the all these federal dollars for environmental justice going to communities that with the most need, right? You also got a term, you know, and talking about this moment, the risk and the reward, Parisa, you got a term called restorative justice, reparative justice. I'm gonna say it differently, reparations. Now, I appreciate the billions of dollars that are coming through the Justice 40 initiative. I appreciate the billions of dollars that are coming out of the Inflation Reduction Act. Those of you who are not familiar with the IRA, think about the rebates for, you know, EVs and all the money out there to move us to clean energy, you know, solar, et cetera. Solar for All program, check that out. You also have monies from the bipartisan infrastructure law. So think about all of our communities who are dealing with poor housing infrastructure, poor transportation infrastructure, right? Poor food. Some of y'all are dealing with food injustice. You may be dealing with food apartheid, right? You don't have access to healthy fruits and vegetables. You don't have access to food forests or community gardens or farmers markets, right? That money is great. But from a reparative justice, from a reparation perspective, that's just a drop in a bucket for the money that's owed. It's a down payment. It is not enough to make communities whole who've been dealing with decades upon decades of intergenerational injustice, right? The cumulative impacts of being left behind, of disinvestment and divestment. Those of y'all who live in redlined communities, right? Those of y'all who are dealing with housing segregation, right? Racial segregation, economic segregation, decades upon decades has been ignored or invisibilized. It's a drop in the bucket. So we need that money to go to these communities. And I appreciate what the administration is doing through different programs. I think there's over 500 y'all federal grant programs out there across the federal family to get these dollars out to communities with the most need. I appreciate that. But the risk is Oh, just saying, that's enough. That is not enough. In the words of Dr. King, we got to bend the arc towards justice, right? I'm paraphrasing. This money is a drop in the bucket to help us bend that arc. The job is not done. So we need to push upon this administration to continue to invest and make sure that we are, in my words, y'all, because I'm about that money. Let me say this. I'm going to say this in a different way. Frontline communities are important. Frontline communities are important. Those at the front line should be at the front of the line when it comes to these dollars, because that is it's reparations, environmental, social reparations for the externalities that you've internalized. The fact you've been poisoned every day by pollution. The fact that you don't have grocery stores. You don't have farmers markets. You don't have transit stops in your community, right? You're used to host highways and byways, right? It's a drop in the bucket. It's important to note and commend and say thank you, but there's more work to be done. The job is not done yet. So I'm gonna stop there because I'm getting
just adding to that, like, you know, it also runs the risk of them say, okay, we solved it. We gave you some money. Did you get that grant? We gave you a grant opportunity, you know? Okay, so that solved it. And when the reality is, like you said, I mean, this is a drop in the bucket. We've got decades of work to do. We've got generations of work to do to completely reform whole agencies and, you know, the approach that is taken. And like you said, it's very intersectional. And right now we still have a lot of silos, right? Like, you know, oh, exactly. You can talk to one agency about this, but, you know, it's about air quality, but you can't, you know, you address the health thing because the health department's not involved in that conversation. It's just the scientists at the air department, whatever. I think we have a caller waiting. I'm going to give them an opportunity to chime in. Caller, could you say your name and your comment or question?
Hello, lady. Here's Rick calling from Germany.
Hi, Rick. Go ahead.
Just a couple of quick comments. First of all, I want to say to the young people, Gogo will be there in the parks live and on recording, but you gotta sit down with the elders, whether they be from Mississippi, the Carolinas, or the DMV. The young folks got to sit down with the elders. You got to sit down with the history books, the religious books, and the science books. I want to say to the young people, we are not going to Mars. Underground NASA is struggling to put 6 to 12 LEO spaceships in orbit of Earth before a pole shift. But we got problems here on Earth. We got problems here on Earth. I would ask your guest, he said he was from Vicksburg. What is the river nearby Vicksburg and how clean is it?
It's the Mississippi River. So Mississippi is important, you know, like the state of Mississippi is a Mississippi River. So there's different parts, there's different pollution inputs into the river, agriculture. You also have a lot of our sewage outfalls that go into the river. And also because of climate change, there's some potential impacts on water quality related to climate change as well. So a lot of our rivers in the US, their concerns about water quality, and how make sure these rivers are fishable and swimmable. But also when you have, because of climate change, that river tends to flood a lot. So if you have communities that are in the floodplain of the river, you know, they can be flooded. So that's one of the issues when you think about that. Ryan made the point about the intersection of environmental justice and climate change. And you think, use the Mississippi River as an example. If you're living near a river and you have extreme rainfall events, right? If you live in a floodplain, that's another risk we have to take into account. So not just the pollution of the river and the water quality, because many of our rivers, like the Mississippi River, may be used for water quality, for drinking water, but also the flood risk for folks who live near the river. And I'll just end there and pass the mic back to Parisa.
No, I appreciate that. And thanks for the call. Let's get into the upcoming event, because I want to make sure we fully, you know, give all this information and encourage the listeners to come out. You have been hosting the Environmental Justice Symposium for several years now. This is the 10th symposium that you've pulled together. Can you talk about the vision behind it, the purpose behind it, and what all takes place during the symposium?
Yeah, thank you. So the full title of the symposium is Symposium on Environmental Justice and Health Disparities. And the reason why that's the title, y'all, is to kind of go back to a previous comment. You know, a lot of environmental exposures, whether it be environmental exposures being chemical stressors, right, chemical exposures, or physical like heat or noise. You can also look at social environment. Your social environment is also a source of exposures. Those exposures can lead to negative health outcome. I mentioned asthma. If you live in older homes, you can have children exposed to lead. We know that lead is a neurocognitive intoxicant, so it puts a cap on children's potential, right? You could also have other, you know, kind of exposures where it can lead to, as I said before, reproductive impacts. Some chemicals can lead to impacts on mutating your DNA, for example. And then, of course, many environmental exposures can lead to cancer as well. And so the whole idea behind the symposium is really to elevate that discussion about how your environment impacts health, first of all. Second of all, the symposium, you know, when I got here, I was a professor at the University of South Carolina before I came to University of Maryland. And I was really floored by, you know, some of the, like, not as many EJ groups, I'll say that way, not as many environmental justice groups being in the region, the DMV region, compared to where I came from in South Carolina, also North Carolina. So remember, I didn't say this, but I grew up in the EJ movement in North Carolina. I went to UNC Chapel Hill. So I shout out to my Naima Muhammad, Gary Grant, Steve Wing was my mentor at UNC who passed away several years ago. And so I grew up with folks, Elsie Herring, who was fighting against industrial hog farms, for those of you who live in the Eastern Shore, Maria and Mike, Pyan, who work on industrial chicken farms, you know, fighting against industrial hog from North Carolina. So I grew up in that kind of space. When I came here, I didn't see as many, you know, frontline fence line EJ groups. And also in North Carolina, I wanted to emulate, they have an annual, really cool, y'all, if y'all get a chance to go, it's always the third weekend of the month of October. They have an annual North Carolina EJ Summit, community based now. Love it, right? Community down home, they got good cooking. They do it on the UCC, United Church of Christ site. And at the Bricks Center in Bricks, North Carolina, right? And so I want to emulate that. Like, we need to have something like that in a DMV region. We need to have a summit, a symposium, right? And we need to build up our EJ movement, because it's all those folks fighting on the ground. And so the idea behind it was really create this space for folks to come together to talk about environmental justice issues, to do this peer-to-peer sharing, right? To create this safe space for folks to come together and learn from each other, to build the movement, to grow the movement. And, you know, the first one was that 2011-2012 period. Maria, I was on the call today with Maria Penn, like, because I couldn't remember, like, was it 2011, Maria? You were on the call to Parisa, I think. 2011-2012. So we had the first one, 2012, and it was co-sponsored by Mustafa Ali. I think Mustafa was still at the EPA. And also Jalon White Newsom, they had both Mustafa and Jalon, Leslie Field as well, and from New Smyrna Travis, those of you, I'm forgetting, like Jacoby, oh, you forgot me. I was also very much involved in planning. But those are four very important people in the planning. And of course, Jalon right now is doing a lot of work leading the EJ program in CEQ, the Council of Environmental Quality. And of course, Mustafa is second in charge. I call him second in charge of the National Wildlife Federation. And so that was very impactful. It was a lot of energy at that first symposium. And out of that came the DMV Environmental Justice Coalition. So it's been a lot of really positive impacts from the symposium. Now, just to fast forward to the symposium that's happening September 11th to 14th. So this is our 10th one, as Parisa said. The theme is past, present, and future of the EJ movement. We're really gonna have a lot of sessions audience on various environmental justice topics that are important for the DMV area, the Mid-Atlantic region, the country, and nationally. So Wednesday is a virtual day, it's all remote. So we're gonna have sessions that are more, you know, international and national focus. So we have a session on human rights, immigration, environmental justice on the first day. We're gonna have a session on community science, right? Because again, community members, y'all are scientists, and how that can lead to real action. We're going to have a session on international environmental justice issues, talk about issues in India and Colombia. We're going to also have sessions on federal environmental justice plans and some of what's happened at the federal level. So that's day one. Day 2 to 4, Thursday to September 12th to September 14th will be hybrid. So we'll have in-person sessions. The in-person part is going to be hosted at the College Park Marriott, which is on the campus of the University of Maryland College Park. And so we're going to start out, basically 9 o'clock every day to going about 5, 6 o'clock. We have some really important figures in the environmental movement, like my friends, people I call my friends, colleagues, mentors, icons of the environmental movement as keynote speakers. So we have Dr. Beverly Wright from the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice. We also have Mustafa Ali, as I said before, with the National Wildlife Federation. Some of y'all know Reverend Yearwood with the Hip Hop Caucus. He's a keynote speaker. And also Vernice Miller Travis, a good friend, one of the founders of the WE Act for Environmental Justice, one of our oldest, most well-known EJ groups based in Harlem, New York, as keynote speakers. We'll have a number of sessions on air quality issues. We'll have a number of sessions on what our state agencies are doing in the Mid-Atlantic region on environmental justice. We'll have sessions on food justice. We'll have sessions on faith-based engagement in environmental justice. We're going to have sessions where we highlight the work of our community partners. So let me slow down a little bit just to get into that. So Parisa used the term TIC-TAC earlier in the introduction. So just for the audience, TIC-TAC stands for Thriving Communities Technical Assistance Center. And let me connect the TIC-TAC to one of my earlier comments and questions for Risa about all this moment with the Biden administration, all the federal dollars out there. So the TIC-TAC is a technical assistance center that provides support to frontline fentanyl communities who are experiencing environmental and energy justice issues in Region 3 of the EPA. Region 3 includes the following states. I'm gonna say states. DC is a state. It needs to be a state. DC, Maryland, Virginia, West Virginia, Delaware, and Pennsylvania. And so the role of the TIC-TAC is provide capacity building support and technical assistance for folks to primarily access those federal dollars. Remember, it's your money, folks. It's the people's money. So that's our primary job. And so we have hub partners. We have community groups who are frontline, fenceline, grassroots groups who are working on environmental, climate, energy justice, who are basically driving what the TIC-TAC does. So Empower DC is our TIC-TAC partner for DC. Centro de Apoyo Familiar, CAF, led by Wakaria Poole, is our TIC-TAC partner for Prince George's County, but also for engagement of Latino, Hispanic, Latinx, Latin communities in Region 3. South Baltimore Community Land Trust, led by Shoshana Campbell, Greg Sautel, Dr. Melanie, and others, Toby. They do a lot of work in Curtis Bay Area, South Baltimore. And then you also have Jerome Shabazz and his team in Philadelphia, the Overbrook Center. And you have Maria and Mike Payan with Sinsley Eastern Shore Health and Sucks and Rum Health Network, as I mentioned before, doing a lot of work on industrial chicken farms. In addition, we have three HBCU partners, Morgan State University, West Virginia State University, and Virginia State University. And we have two new community-based partners, Urban Kind, led by Dr. Jamil Bay, based in Pittsburgh. And then also we have Appalachian Voices that does a lot of work on environmental issues in Appalachia. Those are our partners. So we're gonna have a lot of sessions led by our partners at the symposium. In addition, we're gonna have a lot of grant writing sessions too. For those of you who want to apply for federal grants, like the Community Change Grant, like the funding through the Grant Makers Program, they have to give out $40 million. I'm going to say again, $40 million in our region in the next 3 years. So if you need money to address your local environmental justice issues, you should be applying for Grant Makers funding. Those sessions are going to be led by our core partner, Environmental Finance Center, who's leading the work on, again, training and capacity building around federal grants. We're gonna have sessions on how to use mapping tools to map if you got environmental justice. We're gonna have sessions on how to use air quality monitoring tools if you wanna measure air pollution in your community, right? So number of sessions, I'll stop talking, pass the mic back to Parisa, and if you have follow-up questions, go ahead, Parisa.
Well, yeah, I mean, I just wanna say to the listeners, one, the event is free. come for a day, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days. Come to as much as you can or want to attend. And like Shacobi said, you can come virtual or in person. We're going to be there in person. Empower DC is going to be there in person from September 12th to 14th. We would love to have you join us. You can reach out to me. You can reach out to Empower DC to get additional support. If you have additional questions, we will have a little team of DC residents rolling with us. So we would love to, you know, bring you into the fold. I think, you know, if you're doing work that relates to this, sure, come, you know, but you don't have to be doing work that relates to this. If this is something affecting your community, if you want to learn a little bit more, if you're not even involved yet, but you might want to get involved, you know, this is a great place to come to feel the energy, meet the people, you know, gain some knowledge and relationships, which is, you know, relationships are at the heart of our ability to move change. So, maybe there's an issue that's impacting your neighborhood. You're not quite sure where to begin. Well, come to the symposium and I'm sure you'll get some good, you know, advice and good connections to start on that path. So again, go to online. If you go to siege.center, www.ceej.center, again, ceej.center, you'll get all the information. You'll see the full agenda of events. And yeah, you got to meet Dr. Shacobi Wilson in person if you haven't yet, because he's one of our real superstars. So, Shacobi, any final comments, and we're gonna transition to our next guest. But I want to thank you again for all your leadership, all your work, and yeah, any final comments you'd like to make?
Oh yeah, just really excited. Thank you, because I think I was getting a little long with it there, just y'all into the weeds about the symposium. But it's a really great opportunity, as Parisa said, for you to learn about environmental justice, to build and grow the movement, right? And also the TIC-TAC is here to serve, right? We do science that serves. That's what my center does. And we're about, the TIC-TAC is about serving communities as well. So once you come to the symposium, if you need help, like Parisa said, you can go through our intake process and you can get technical assistance in real time at the symposium, right? We have right now about 3,000 registrants across all 4 days virtually, and we have about 1,000 folks for in-person. But please go ahead and register. As Parisa said, it is free. It's a great opportunity to learn and grow and be a part of this local EJ movement. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Shacobi Wilson. Everybody look him up on social media, follow the Siege Center, follow him and whatever he's doing next, because he's a great leader in our region and we just appreciate everything you do. Thanks, Shacobi. I'll see you at the symposium.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, audience.
And I'm really happy to welcome our next guests, Tabara Smith and Justice Watson from the Emerald Cities Collaborative. They're doing great work to build our local infrastructure for DC area contractors and other folks to ensure that we are able to achieve climate justice and environmental justice through the way that we build, which is a huge contributor to the pollution that we experience in our community. So thank you, Tabaris and Justice, for joining me today.
Thank you for having us, Parisa.
We're excited to have you. So we don't have a lot of time. We have about 11 minutes. So we'll go ahead and dive right in. If you could share just a little bit about Emerald Cities Collaborative, and then of course get into this program that you are currently recruiting for.
Thank you, Parisa, again for having us. Emerald Cities Collaborative is a national nonprofit that focuses on three basic bottom lines: is environment, equity, and economy. And this is we have five different regions across the country, including the Southern California region, the Bay Area region, Seattle, Tacoma area, the Boston metro region, and our newest region is the DMV region, which most of our work is located in the DC. This program is part of our economic inclusion portfolio, and I would pass it to my colleague Justice to talk a little bit more about this program.
Yes, thank you, Tabaris. Thank you for having us on the station. We're really excited to be here. So the DC Contractor Incubator is a program that supports and uplifts small and minority construction businesses in the district. We work to help those businesses get access to clean energy projects in the district. So it is an 8-week training program that consists of different sessions catered to a variety of different topics like access to capital, project opportunities, marketing, and so on and so forth. We have so many different opportunities for our contractors to learn and develop and grow their businesses. And in addition to those 8 weeks, we have up to 2 years of coaching and technical assistance provided as well. So our contractors, after completing the program, have the opportunity to enlist in coaching. And so what that consists of is developing a coaching plan that is from 6 to 18 months of, you know, check-ins, and we're able to keep track of their progress and just see how they're growing. And we also operate on a referral process. So if there's something that we can't support in-house as far as technical assistance, we will reach out to our many partners that we work with to provide the services that they need. So that's about the program in a nutshell. But if you have any other questions, I'm happy to answer.
That's great that you're providing such tailored support. So, you know, it's not a cookie cutter, right? Like everybody is at a different stage of development. You're able to kind of link them with the right people. Talk a little bit more about who's eligible for this program.
So we are looking for construction businesses that operate in clean energy spaces. So HVAC, electrical, and the like. And if you are not operating in that space, we ask that you are interested in getting into that space. And you must be a minority-owned or woman-owned business, have to have been in operation for at least 3 years. And we are looking for previous annual revenues of $250,000 to $1.2 million or $1.5 million. So really kind of those middle ground businesses, like not startup construction businesses, but not super advanced construction businesses either. We're really wanting to help out those who can take on large projects, but just maybe need a little bit of support, with their back office or figuring out their structure of their business and, you know, all of those kinds of things. So, yeah, I think that's about it. Tabaris, let me know if I missed anything with that. Okay, great.
And based in DC, Maryland, or Virginia, right? So any.
Yes, obviously. Yeah, I missed that part. Yeah. So, based in DC, Maryland, or Virginia.
Yeah, so we prefer DC based businesses, but we know that a lot of people live outside of DC, so they have to be interested in doing work in the district.
So a lot of the opportunities that you're preparing people for are in the district.
Right.
Is that right?
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
And so this is the second round. How do people apply for this or get more information? How do people apply and get involved?
Yeah, of course. So they are welcome to follow us on social media, LinkedIn, Instagram. We post about it at least once a week. We have a website that we've created through Canva that specifically talks about the DC Contractor Incubator. Because we are the newest region to Emerald Cities, our website for the DMV region is not updated just yet. But what I can do is drop the link in the chat, and maybe you could share that out with the folks who listen to this station. But also just following us on LinkedIn and Instagram is the best way, because they will get that flyer directly on LinkedIn and Instagram posts.
Okay. And so, yeah, feel free to reach out to Empower DC if you're listening right now and you need this link. I'll also make sure that we post it on our social media so that you have it available there. And the deadline is coming up September 11th, right? At midnight.
Yes. So. Yes. The deadline is September 11th, and the training begins on September 18th. The sessions are from 4 to 7, but the first two sessions, September 18th and 25th, will be 3 to 7.
What is there? I know you just finished out your first session. Do you want to just share a highlight or a success story that came out of that?
Yeah, so I could talk a little bit about that currently. We have 15 businesses from 15 out of the 20. So we graduated 25 contractors from the last cohort. 15 out of those 25 contractors was from wards 5, 7, and 8. We actually had 24 BIPOC businesses, and all the businesses was identified as diverse businesses, which is including 11 women, which was very excited about. We also placed emphasis on increasing different capacities of these different businesses. So we completed 250 technical assistance hours for these businesses. We also identify 21 out of 25, 21 out of those 25 contractors actually did coaching plans that kind of will redirect and pivot their business model to a more sustainable business model in the coming over the next 18 months. Justice, am I missing something?
No, I was literally like, you covered everything.
Oh, and one thing we wanted to mention is like, we the first contractor incubator in the country that focus on the building energy performance standard in DC, in the country actually. So we kind of created this academy to center around the building energy performance standard in DC, which would create almost 4,000 new jobs and 4,000 new opportunities over the course of the next 7 years. So we're happy to take on that responsibility, and we're looking forward to working with more contractors in the district to actually pivot their business models to a more sustainable one.
And Tamara, say a couple more words about those building performance standards for the listeners who may not even know that, things are moving in a new direction and their businesses, are going to want to take advantage of that or need to.
Yeah.
What should folks know about that?
So the building energy performance standard is a standard that was created by the district in 2018. And the whole goal was to make sure that buildings, we reduce our carbon emissions within the buildings, because the buildings in the district is around 71% of the greenhouse gas reduction, greenhouse gas emissions in the district. So the council actually created this policy so they can reduce the emissions in those buildings. So right now we in phase one, which is the buildings that's 50,000 square feet buildings. In the next couple of years, we'll be in phase two, which is around 25,000 square feet. And then the other phases of buildings that's around 10,000 square feet, which will put a lot of smaller buildings and smaller opportunities for contractors things. So Emerald City's kind of complete a study that this new economy will open up the doors for almost $400 million in investment and create over 4,000 jobs. So what our goal was to kind of create a space for minority contractors and minority workers to kind of be a part of this economy and actually take advantage of this opportunity of community wealth building and drive that opportunity to get down in those deeper buildings. In wards 7 and 8, it's over 300 buildings that have to comply with this law. And so we want to make sure that if you're going to work in those wards, you have to be local, and you have to have local businesses that can actually do that type of work. So we're excited for this opportunity, and we're excited to actually get more minority contractors and Black-owned contractors and brown contractors a part of this opportunity.
That's wonderful work that you're doing. I want to, again, encourage folks to look up Emerald Cities Collaborative. I'm sure if you Google the contractor incubator, you'll find it, but I will make sure to post the link also on Empower DC's social media. And, definitely follow Emerald Cities and stay in touch with all of the work that they're doing. This is just the contractor cohort, but you have other programs as well, and you're growing your DMV presence. So appreciate you both. Any final words you'd like to leave us with?
No, thank you so much, Parisa, for having us. And we're looking forward to not only working with you, but working with your community to actually uplift more minorities and making sure that minorities get benefit from these investments that's driving in the DMV and also the DC.
Right.
Really. Thank you so much, Parisa. Thank you.
Thanks, Justice and Tavares. And thanks to the listeners taking action. Appreciate everybody in the studio, WPFW. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, keep listening. Stay tuned for COVID, Race, and Democracy. But first, the news.
Good afternoon. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Here are some headlines for this hour. Just over a week ago, on Monday, August 19th, the Department of Homeland Security implemented the President Biden-approved policy known as Keeping Families Together. This policy, which is also referred to as a parole-in-place program, allows immigrant spouses of United States citizens to remain in the country while their applications for permanent residence are considered. A federal judge in Texas, however, has now temporarily blocked that policy. His decision affects about 500,000 foreign-born spouses of U.S. citizens who are eligible for President Biden's initiative. Immigration advocates condemned the judge's ruling as, quote, heartbreaking, saying it could separate mixed-status families for years or even permanently while their lengthy green card applications are processed. The judge who blocked the policy, J. Campbell Barker, made his ruling in response to a lawsuit that was filed on Friday from 16 Republican attorney generals who claim that President Biden's policy amounts to a blanket amnesty or exoneration for people who enter the country illegally. Judge Barker was appointed to his position under the Trump administration. It has been over 10 months since the Israel-Hamas war began on October 7th, 2023. And now, a hostage who had been held captive all that time by Hamas has been rescued. He's a 52-year-old father of 11 from southern Israel named Kaid Farhan Al-Qadi. He's the eighth hostage that has been rescued alive in Gaza by the Israeli military since the beginning of the war. According to an Israeli military spokesman, Mr. Al-Qadi was rescued from a tunnel in southern Gaza by Israeli forces. His rescue marks the first time that a hostage has been reclaimed alive from inside Hamas's stretching tunnel network underneath Gaza. At the time of his rescue, Mr. Al-Qadi was in stable medical condition and taken to the hospital for a checkup. His brother described his rescue as, quote, feeling better than being born again. Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu spoke to Mr. Al-Qadi on video, saying that he did not forget any hostage, including him. Speaking of that, there are more than 100 hostages who remain in Hamas custody. Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook's parent company, Meta, is speaking out about pressure he says his company received from the government about COVID-related posts. Zuckerberg said in a letter, and I quote, in 2021, senior officials from the Biden administration, including the White House, repeatedly pressured our teams for months to censor certain COVID-19 content, including humor and satire, and expressed a lot of frustration with our teams when we didn't agree, end quote. In August 2021, Facebook said it had removed more than 20 million posts related to COVID-19 for violating its content rules across the main social networking site and Instagram. Zuckerberg said it was ultimately Meta's decision to take down any content, but he wrote that he believes the alleged government pressure was wrong. Zuckerberg said he regrets that Meta wasn't more outspoken about the pressure to censor COVID content, but he promises that they are ready to push back if something like this happens again from another presidential administration. To the D.C. area, the first vaccine for lung cancer is set to be tested in Maryland and Virginia as part of a global clinical trial. The vaccine targets the most common type of lung cancer, which is non-small cell lung cancer, also known as NSCLC. The vaccine for it, known as BNT116, is designed to eliminate cancer cells and prevent the cancer from returning in a patient by training the immune system to recognize and attack tumor markers that are specific to NSCLC. The BNT116 vaccine, which is made by German biotechnology company BioNTech, is said to use the same technology that's instrumental in COVID-19 vaccines. In today's weather, it's currently about 91 degrees in D.C. That's all for